So this is the first Sunday of Advent, so we are beginning a new, very short series of sermons that will happen during these four Sundays of Advent, and it is called Pathways to Deliverance. And here is how it's going to work. We are going to look at the beginnings of the stories of Jesus and Moses, recognizing that in the narrative of Scripture, they both are people who are deliverers. Obviously, Moses in the Old Testament through the Exodus story, and then, of course, Jesus with ultimate deliverance through his incarnation, resurrection, crucifixion, resurrection. So we're going to look at the stories of these two deliverers, and we're sort of going to set them side by side and dig in a little deeper into each one of them, look at some of the details, sort of settle in for a while, and then take those two stories and ask, okay, how are these similar? Where are there overlaps in these stories between these two deliverers and their pathways? And then really end up with a question, so what does that mean for us today? What can we find in these stories that challenge and teach us even yet today about God's pathway of deliverance for us? So today we're talking about origin stories. Both Jesus and Moses have very interesting origin stories in their own ways. They are miraculous, and they set the stage for the importance that will come in the rest of their lives. But if you're anything like me, you hear the phrase origin story, and you immediately think of our superhero culture. Because it's the origin stories of these characters that really set the stage for what's going to happen in the rest of their lives as they unfold in our comic books and on our movie screens. If you're familiar with them, you already know Captain America was once Steve Rogers, a 98-pound weakling that was transformed as part of a super secret super soldier project when America was facing her greatest enemy and he became the ultimate human fighting machine. You know probably a story of Superman whose home planet of Krypton, see, I knew you guys were with me, was facing destruction, so he was jettisoned away on a rocket that ended up landing on Earth and was found and raised by a very compassionate elderly couple, and it became increasingly clear over time that the yellow sun of Earth gave the boy powers beyond our imagination. Spider-Man, another slightly different origin story. You have Peter Parker, the nerdy student constantly picked on by the cool kids at school, gets bitten by a radioactive spider and finds that he has now enhanced strength, the ability to climb walls, and a handy-dandy spider sense so that he knows when danger is near. And then my personal favorite, the Batman origin story, is one of tragedy. As a young boy, Bruce Wayne sees his parents brutally gunned down right in front of him, so he spends years and years achieving both peak physical and mental and training conditions in order to fight against the kind of criminals that murdered his own parents. Origin stories matter. They set the stage for what's going to happen in those stories of those characters. The origin stories of Jesus and Moses matter. They tell us about what is to come. So let's look today, first of all, at the origin story of Moses. We find it in Exodus chapter 2, starting in verse 1. A man of the tribe of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her female slave to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying, and she felt sorry for him. "This is one of the Hebrew babies," she said. Then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you?" "Yes, go," she answered. And so the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you." So the woman took the baby and nursed him. And when the child grew older, she took him into Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she gave him the name Moses, saying, "I drew him out of the water." Now, next Sunday, we will get to more of the circumstances that surround the birth of Moses. mostly because they represent another entirely separate parallel between the story of Jesus and the story of Moses that I want to look at specifically. But for now, we'll just agree that it is not normative behavior to hide a newborn baby for 3 months and then float him down the river in a basket. This is very, very uncommon behavior for very good reason, because of the context of what's going on in Egypt at this time. Now, unlike the story of Jesus, which we'll get to momentarily, the portion of Moses' origin story that is relating to his time in utero includes absolutely nothing out of the ordinary that we are aware of. However, things change quite quickly. The story of Moses, in fact, should have ended quickly and abruptly, because at the time that Moses is born and the Hebrew people are slaves in Egypt, we're told in Exodus chapter 1, which we'll talk more about next time, that every Hebrew baby boy that is born is to be what? Thrown into the Nile. Moses' story should have ended abruptly and quickly, and yet it didn't. Why is that? Well, first of all, it's because his mother kept him hidden for 3 months after his birth. Can you imagine the time of tension that existed in that household for 3 months' time? Just sort of walking on eggshells and wondering when we might get found out. You know, Moses' mom and dad whispering to each other, trying to keep things under wraps. The brothers and sisters kind of maybe knowing what's going on, maybe not fully. I mean, imagine if they had been found out. If she'd been caught, not only would the baby perish anyway, but then she's probably going to face some sort of consequences, perhaps even her own death. There had to be a lot of tension. Listen, if you thought it was tense to eat a Thanksgiving meal with your in-laws, that was nothing compared to what was being felt around the tables of the people in Moses' household at this time. And on one hand, it was probably easy to keep concealed for 3 months a baby. Why? Because those things are small. Like those newborn babies, those are teeny tiny things. It is relatively easy to keep them hidden somewhere, stash them away. However, on the other hand, I think it might have been hard to hide a newborn for 3 months, because even though they might be small, those things are very, very loud as well. Very loud. How loud, you're asking? Well, I'm glad you asked. Because a 2014 study at Eastern Kentucky University revealed that the sound of a crying baby hits on average somewhere between 100 and 120 decibels. Those elevated noise levels, the study found, from crying children can cause acute discomfort and pain, yep, to those who are exposed. And theoretically, there is a risk, if you have chronic long-term exposure to those intense sound pressures, that you could have some noise-induced hearing loss as a parent. Further, 120 decibels. Those cries compare to the noise that's generated by a snowmobile and is only 10 decibels below that of an airplane departure. So if you've ever held a screaming baby and thought, I might rather stand next to a jet engine, you are probably closer than you think. So there came a time when hiding this baby is no longer feasible because of size and maybe because of volume. And when that became impossible, Moses' mother, in her own way, did eventually follow the decree of Pharaoh, sorta, kinda. She did put that young baby in the Nile River, but she did so in a basket that was coated, we're told, with tar and pitch, making it able to stay afloat. It would avoid taking on water, not to mention muffling the potential cries at 120 decibels from the young one that is inside. But if you've seen art depictions of this story of taking Moses in the basket and putting him out into the Nile, if the picture of the Nile we get is this very tranquil place with just still waters and almost like a backyard stream of sorts, that is not what the Nile River is like. Now, I've never seen it myself, but I did some research this week and found out that the Nile River holds many dangerous things: snakes, spiders, huge aggressive animals, crocodiles, on top of waterborne illnesses and diseases and some sort of parasite called schistosomiasis, something like that. I don't actually know how to pronounce it. The Nile is not a friendly, tranquil place. It is not a place you want to float a baby on. It does not look like a backyard stream. It was a very dangerous place for Moses to be floating. The placing of that basket in the water is an instance where if you look under the hood of the original language, which I was able to do this week, you can tell that this story is actually already hinting at some divine activity that's under the surface. And here's why. The Hebrew word that is used there for the basket that Moses is floated in is the same Hebrew word that's used in the book of Genesis for Noah's ark. So that baby is floated in a basket, but that basket is reminiscent of an ark. So if you are a Hebrew person, you're hearing this story, and you know the Genesis stories already, you know, okay, hang on, there's something coming. Something is up with this story because this baby is floating in an ark, and an ark survives. I might put it this way. There's a big difference between helplessly putting a baby in a basket and hopefully putting a baby in an ark. And it seems that Moses' mother is doing the second. That this baby is somehow being floated with a sense of hope. And that basket finds the most unlikely person, the daughter of Pharaoh, is presented with what I think we can safely call an unexpected baby. She sees the basket, asks a servant to bring it up. She opens the basket. We're told that this royal princess has gone to bathe in the Nile River, which sounds weird. We just talked about how there are snakes and spiders and crocodiles and all sorts of things. So I had to look it up and find, why is the royal princess not bathing in her really, really fancy tub of some sort that I'm sure she had in the palace? What is she doing bathing in the Nile? Well, it turns out the Nile was an integral part of the Egyptian religion, and that there was a particular sacredness to portions of the Nile that flowed along the temples that were built as a part of the Egyptian religion. And at those places, they would actually fence off little portions of the river and even build little enclosures so that you could take sort of ceremonial religious baths in the Nile, almost as an act of worship. And so that's what the princess is most likely doing there. She sees the basket that's brought up to her. She opens the lid, and immediately says what? This is one of the Hebrew babies. Now, this is the second time that Moses' story should have ended abruptly. This is Pharaoh's daughter. Her dad made the rules. She knows what the rules are. She has no excuse. She knows what's supposed to be done at this point. At the very least, she should have deposited that baby back into the basket ark and floated it back down the river. But she didn't. We're told that she realizes this is a Hebrew baby, but she hears the cry, and what did we find out? She feels sorry for him. Her heart is softened. She's moved to sympathy and compassion. And I think this is really significant because I think we should assume that she's been conditioned by her culture and her family to see these Hebrew people as both threatening and disposable. That's the attitude she's been given about who these Hebrew people are, and therefore this Hebrew baby should be of absolutely no consequence to her. And yet, she hears the cry, she is moved with compassion. A non-Israelite motivated by compassion plays a critical role in the future deliverance of God's people. And I draw your attention here because this is not the last time this will happen. It happens over and over and over again. Sometimes we get the idea that we like have the corner on compassion and sympathy and care. No. God all the time uses all kinds of people to continue to move his deliverance story forward. And there's someone watching this all play out because Moses' sister then realizes she might be able to spare her brother. Now, the first miracle here is that she likes her brother. That is not always the case. But she loves her brother enough, and she senses this might be an opportunity to spare his life. And I'm reading the story, and we don't have all the details, but I'm wondering, how long did she wait? How far downstream did she have to follow this basket ark? How did she discern that it was the right moment to offer this suggested solution to this Egyptian princess? I don't know. But I do know she's become one of my favorite parts of the story because she shows a combination of care. She loves her brother. Patience. She's willing to wait and wait until the moment is right. Discernment, knowing when it's the best time to act. And let's be honest, outright bravery. A little slave girl has no business approaching the daughter of the king. And yet she does, because she senses that this is an opportunity to save her brother. And then, in like the ultimate twist of divine intervention, sort of dressed up as irony, who gets to actually nurse the baby to health? His own mother. You read the story and you kind of go, so God's going to save the baby? Oh, it's going to be way better than that. Way better. Because that baby is going to actually be brought back home, nursed by his own mother, and on top of it, did you catch it? Paid from the bank account of the guy who wanted the baby dead in the first place. Incredible, right? Absolutely incredible. It's as if God is saying, just wait to see how this plays out. It reminds me of Ephesians 3, where it tells us he is able to do immeasurably more than we could ever ask or imagine. And eventually, this baby grows in the household of Pharaoh, is given the name Moses, and the name means what? To draw out of the water, which, as we read the story, we know, that yes, that's true of Moses. He was drawn out of the water, but ultimately, through Moses' leadership, the entirety of God's people will be drawn out of the water as the parting of the sea happens. His origin story sort of hints at what is yet to come. So let's move on to Jesus. Matthew chapter 1, starting in verse 18. This is how the birth of Jesus, the Messiah, came about. His mother, Mary, was pledged to be married to Joseph, but before they came together, she was found to be pregnant through the Holy Spirit. Because Joseph, her husband, was faithful to the law, and yet did not want to expose her to public disgrace, he had in mind to divorce her quietly. But after he had considered this, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream and said, Joseph, son of David, do not be afraid to take Mary home as your wife, because what is conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit. She will give birth to a son, and you are to give him the name Jesus, because he will save his people from their sins. All this took place to fulfill what the Lord had said through the prophet. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son, and they will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. When Joseph woke up, he did what the angel of the Lord had commanded them, and he took Mary home as his wife. But he did not consummate their marriage until she gave birth to a son, and he gave him the name Jesus. Now, this is the origin story of Jesus in quotes, because we recognize as Christians, Jesus is eternally existent as the Son within the Trinity. But this is sort of the origin story of the birth of Jesus. And like the story of Moses, the story of Jesus is one that we should expect early on would come to a screeching halt. Why? Because Mary is pledged to be married to Joseph. We read the word pledge, we don't quite understand it. It's much more serious than even an engagement today. Binding promises have been made by these people and by their families. They're basically legally married except for one public celebration that still remains. And the news then that Mary is pregnant without them ever having slept together can logically, on the surface, only mean one thing. Mary has broken that promise. Now, of course, as we read the story, we know there's more going on below the surface. This baby has been divinely placed within her womb. And listen, if Pharaoh's daughter receiving Moses in a basket was an unexpected baby, this is like a whole new level of unexpected baby that happens to Mary. And yet she receives this unexpected news. In the story of Moses, it is the life of Moses that is in danger. In the origin story of Jesus, it's Mary's life that is actually now in danger. According to the Jewish law in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 22, a woman who is pledged to be married and violates that promise by sleeping with another man, her punishment was supposed to be death by stoning, along with her partner in crime. Now, we understand that by the time we get to this point in Jewish history, that it's unlikely that that kind of punishment would have actually been carried out. Not impossible, but unlikely. But even if she was not physically killed, this is certainly a social death of sorts for Mary, because a premarital pregnancy would likely ruin any chances she would ever have at finding a spouse, and she would likely be rejected by her own family. So she may not physically die, but socially she is facing a sort of death at very minimum. And Joseph, when he finds out about this whole thing, he's kind of stuck. I think we can safely assume that he loves Mary. They have been brought together and they have developed this relationship. They're almost husband and wife legally. But as much as he loves Mary, he's now stuck. He has to prove that he loves God even more. We're told he's a just or a righteous man. And if he is a just or righteous man, the only right thing to do to show that you love God more than even this woman is to, at minimum, divorce her. Because it says in Deuteronomy, that's the only way to purge the evil. He needs to put her out. In order, that's the right and just, the righteous thing to do. Additionally, let's say Joseph wanted to overlook this development. Let's say he wanted to give Mary a second chance before he understands what's actually happening. Even if he did that and still brought her home as his wife, people would assume that he's the one who had gotten her pregnant, so his good name, his reputation, would be absolutely sullied if he kept her. He is absolutely stuck. He had every right to drag her to the town gate, to the most public place in the village, the place where all the legal decisions actually happen. He had every right to make a spectacle of her apparent failure, to call for the most just punishment. In fact, this would have been the necessary route if he wanted to keep the dowry that had been received. All of this is playing into his decision. But Joseph is not moved by righteous judgment, though he has every right to be. Instead, he's moved by compassion. His heart is softened. We read in the story that he does intend to divorce Mary, but he intends to do so how? Quietly. To save her from as much public disgrace as possible. And this is a different method of divorce. Instead of dragging her to the town gate and making a spectacle of her publicly, he could actually get a certificate of divorce, present it to her in just the company of a few witnesses, and it would have the same effect. And that is what he intends, because his heart is softened toward this woman that he loves. His heart is softened even further because he has a dream and an angelic visitation. He receives some extra information. But the first thing, before any information, he's told what? The same thing that gets told in the Bible over and over again. Do not be afraid. Specifically, do not be afraid to take Mary as your wife, even though you know all of this. So now we know that Joseph's motivations for seeking a kindly, quiet divorce is not just about his righteousness in the law or his standing among his peers, but it's also driven at least in part by what? By fear. By fear. How often does fear truly drive our decision-making as human beings? I think that fear drives our choices far more often and far more deeply than we want to admit. I read an article this week that had this quote in it: fear causes us to slam on the brakes. It immobilizes us when we have the greatest need for strength. Fear gives us jitters at the very moment when there is the greatest premium on clarity. And so the angel says, do not be afraid to still take Mary as your wife. Joseph is somehow invited to believe that God is yet at work behind all of this, which, listen, when things are going according to your plan, it's easy to believe that God is at work. When you have things laid out, A, B, C, and D, and everything goes according to what you have in mind, it's relatively easy to be like, oh, the Lord is at work among all this. But the moment A, B, and C happen, and then you skip to W, you go, whoa, the Lord must not be at work in all of this because my plans are not coming to fruition. It is much more challenging to believe that God is yet at work when the plans that you see in front of you are not the plans that you have. Joseph gets some other information. He's told the gender of the baby, that it's going to be a son, at which point I imagine Joseph waking up being like, thanks a lot, angel. I had this gender reveal party planned. There was going to be a cake and there was going to be fireworks. We're going to shoot stuff out of cannons. No, not really. But he finds out this is going to be a baby boy, which is obviously important in his own culture. He finds out the name given should be Jesus, and he finds out that the purpose of this baby's life is to save and deliver the people from their sins. And what I find really remarkable is that Joseph wakes up and immediately wastes no time. He goes to Mary, he takes her home as his wife. He doesn't ponder, he doesn't think through. He receives this message and he immediately goes. But can you imagine how much relief Mary must have felt when he returned to her and said, "No, we're gonna stick this out." And it's because Joseph decided his obedience to the direction of God mattered more than the condition of his reputation in the eyes of other people. So what commonalities, what overlap, what parallels do we see in these two stories, and what questions do they then still have for us today? Well, first of all, we see unexpected developments in both of these stories. Both Mary and Pharaoh's daughter faced different versions of unexpected babies. We know from other biblical accounts, for instance, Luke chapter 1, that Mary was initially fearful and confused, just as Joseph was, but eventually she embraced this unexpected status of being a new mother. Pharaoh's daughter, though conditioned to be fearful and suspicious of the Hebrew people, not to mention upsetting her dad, embraced this unexpected opportunity to raise a child. Which brings us to sort of this question: is there something happening in your life that is maybe unexpected or unplanned? Is something sort of being born in your life that maybe needs care or compassion? Secondly, we see softened hearts in both of these origin stories. Pharaoh's daughter had to overcome the hardness of heart that came with this inherited prejudice about who the Hebrew people were in order to have compassion on this baby that would be called Moses. Joseph had to overcome the hardness of heart that goes along with like this social pride of doing the right thing in the eyes of the law and the right thing in the eyes of other people in order to have compassion on Mary and follow through with making her his wife. Are we opening to God continuing to soften our hearts today and in ways that he desires to do? We also see unlikely people in both of these stories. God uses very unexpected people, people who would be far from being labeled as important, to move this grand narrative of deliverance and redemption forward. Moses, Moses' mother, Moses' sister, they are all slaves in the Egyptian empire, far from royal palaces. They don't even have the full rights of the citizens of Egypt. I mean, my goodness, Moses' mom and sister don't even get names in the story. They're not even named. And yet they play absolutely critical roles in the story that God is telling. Joseph and Mary, they are not closely connected with any of the real difference makers in their day. These aren't the kids of the high priest or the Pharisees or the teachers of the law. They're not in the household of the powerful Jewish political figures. None of that. Reminds me of the verse in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. God chooses the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. And he chooses the weak things of the world to shame the strong. How do we expect God's activity in the world to shake up today? Through the influential and the well-known, or through the more anonymous? And then lastly, we see deliberate design in both of these stories. At the very base level, through the names given to these babies. They're both given names that are connected to their destinies. Their pathways are being laid out even before anybody has any idea what God intends to accomplish with their lives. Do we believe that God is still pushing forward his good purposes in our world, his deliberate design? And are we answering the call to join him in the work that he is doing? So in the spirit of those things, let's think and pray through some ways we can respond and reflect. And these are in your bulletin if you want to take them home and think some more about them this week. Has something unexpected or unplanned come into your life recently? Are you maybe being invited to show compassion or care in a meaningful or a concrete way? Secondly, ask God to reveal to you if you've been holding on to a hardness of heart in some way that actually holds you back from following his direction. Third, how do you expect God to most often or most powerfully work in our world? Is it through well-known and influential people or through unknown and potentially powerless people? Because it seems that God prefers to work through the unknown and the powerless much of the time. Lastly, let's pray together that we would be attentive to the divine design that's around us and that we can faithfully respond to God's calling and God's leading according to those good purposes. So I'm going to flip through these as I do each week, and maybe one of them just sort of grabs your attention, your heart to focus in on as we have this moment of silence so that maybe the Holy Spirit can speak a little more clearly and plainly to each one of us. And I'm going to close that time of reflection in just a moment with a word of prayer.